Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Last Thursday, a San Francisco police sergeant shot and killed Jessica Williams, an unarmed 29-year-old black woman. Williams was allegedly fleeing officers in a suspected stolen car. The San Francisco Chronicle reports police said there was no immediate indication that the woman was armed or had been driving the car toward officers when she was shot. Williams' death is the San Francisco Police Department's third fatal shooting in 6 months. And this comes after weeks of community pressure demanding Chief Greg Suhr resigned. Last month, the Frisco Five hunger strikers drew national attention to additional SFPD-involved fatalities, resulting in the deaths of Maria Woods, Alex Nieto, Amilcar Lopez, and Luis Gongora, all men of color. Within hours of Jessica Williams' death, San Francisco Police Chief Greg Suhr resigned at the request of Mayor Ed Lee. So a lot of people are wondering, what is next for the SFPD? What reforms are on the table, and what would you like to see? Today, we are joined by John Burris. He is a civil rights attorney specializing in police misconduct cases for over 30 years. John represents Luis Gongora and Mario Woods' family. The Woods shooting was the impetus for reform. John has represented over 1,000 victims of police misconduct throughout the state of California. He was co-counsel in the Oakland Riders case, which received a $11.4 million settlement for 119 victims. It also placed Oakland under federal court supervision to enact a series of reforms. The department is still seeking to complete those after 13 years. And John Burris joins me in studio. Hi, John. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
Nice to have you. Mm-hmm. We're also joined by Adriana Camarena. She is a writer and community advocate in San Francisco's Mission District. Adriana attended the officer's trial over the killing of Alex Nieto. She's co-founder of the Justice for Alex Nieto Coalition. She's also working as an advocate for Justice for Luis Gongora, who was killed on April 7th, 2016. And Adriana also joins us in studio. Hi. Thank you for coming in.
Hello. Good morning. Morning.
And we're joined by Rebecca Young. Rebecca has been a criminal defense attorney for more than 30 years. She is a senior trial attorney with the San Francisco Deputy Public Defender's Office, where she also co-chairs the Racial Justice Committee. In 2014, the group drafted a 10-point police department reform plan to address the disparate treatment of African Americans by police. And Rebecca also joins us in studio. Hi, Rebecca.
Good morning. Great to be here.
It's great to have all of you. So I wanted to start off by asking you to provide some context, because honestly, it's been difficult to even keep up with these shootings. And Rebecca, the Racial Justice Committee sent a letter to the San Francisco Board of Supervisors on May 3rd stating that over the last few years, we have seen multiple instances of both explicit racism and implicit bias. Rather than diminishing, the SFPD bigotry problem continues to unfold. And you write that the saga of conduct began in January 2011. So give us a little bit of context. I mean, this didn't just start 6 months ago.
No, and it also didn't just start in January 2011. But what happened then was the Henry Hotel incident. And so I think in recent years, what is increasing the visibility for us as public defenders is that we have video. And we are storing the video, we are watching the video, and we are seeing an incredible pattern of excessive use of force, of Fourth Amendment violations, of stop and searches without reasonable or probable cause. So probably for public defenders, we live it day in and day out, and we have plenty of context for what's going on. And so when there's a killing that appears to be quite unjustified, as it did for both Alex Nieto, which we don't have on video, but also for Mario Woods, which is on video, and then the police come out and justify it as an act of reasonable force and use of self-defense, it's really time to act.
And John, what would you add to that? I mean, you've been working on these issues for decades, but when we're talking specifically about what's happening in San Francisco and so many calls for Chief Suhr to resign, so many calls for reform, what would you add to that? What kind of information do we need to really understand what's happening?
Well, I think that Rebecca's point is well taken, that there's a historical pattern here that has not started in the last 30 days or the last several years. It's been an ongoing issue for many, many years. I've been involved in San Francisco cases as for as long as I can remember, during my entire 30-year period, I've always had cases in San Francisco. But I also think this is an opportunity, given the recent untimely shootings, wrongful shootings, the racial tirades that have taken place, what I see is an opportunity here to really bring about significant reform and tackle the it's an entrenched problem, but it can be tackled. Now is the time to do it. We have the Justice Department has come in, just making recommendations. We have the public defender's offices on it. My office is on it. Other groups are on it. And now it's really a function of is this the right time? And there's an interest and a commitment on the part of the police commission as well as the mayor's office to really see if they can change the culture, which is important in SFPD. And so it's a cultural change that has to take place. I've been involved in racial profiling and illegal stops and seizures and death cases, you name it. I've been involved in cases in San Francisco. And so this, is to me, is an opportunity to really bring about change. And I think Rebecca said, nothing's more significant in bringing about this change or focusing up the issue than the video cameras, both the personal cameras that people have, because they really have shed a light and allowed the rest of the community to see what really happens. And it cannot be any we must give as much credit as we can to the importance of having video cameras for all officers at all points in time, so that we all can see what's taking place. And it serves as a basis for reform, because this is an opportunity to do that.
And that is longtime civil rights attorney John Burris. And I also want to mention that we did reach out to the San Francisco Police Department and Officers for Justice, but we did not hear back. And Adriana, you're a community advocate. You have been working with the families of people who have lost their lives, mostly young men. Can you talk a little bit about what their plan of action is from here on out? Because we did a show about 2 weeks ago about the Frisco Five hunger strikers, and I believe we did it on day 10.
Right.
So what are you hearing from them?
Well, first of all, I think it's really important to think about the context of this latest killing of Jessica Williams, coming after more than two years since the Alex Nieto shooting. The Alex Nieto shooting happened before Ferguson. And so it took huge community involvement to raise the profile of that case. As Rebecca mentioned, there wasn't a video. And so it is through community advocacy that we've gotten to this point that culminating with the Frisco Five, where more community members beyond the family members were involved in this case is calling for justice. So we just, as a community advocates, we like to point out that it wasn't Ed Lee who fired Chief Sir. It was the people who fired Chief Sir. And so in the coming stage of policy reforms, there has to be community involvement. The families, specifically, I work with Elvira and Refugio Nieto, who lost her son Alex on March 21st, 2014, in a hail of 59 bullets in an open public park. And now in the latest case of Luis Góngora Pat, which was the trigger of the Frisco Five, I'm now involved with a family, which is a Mayan Mexican family of many of them are undocumented and day laborers. But most importantly, they're people who are situated in positions of vulnerability that if we don't engage as community members and start looking at what are the special needs that these families face, and also just keep our finger on the demands of the coalitions, because they reflect what at the heart is the problem. We've called for the resignation of Chief Sir. We are calling for the officers to be charged for murder in all these cases. And we're also calling for independent federal investigation into all these salient cases. But what it really tells you is that there is a lack of accountability in all police shootings. We want to end the culture of impunity, and we have to see why there isn't accountability. And this is the heart of the reforms that we all want.
And can you talk about that, Rebecca? What about accountability? What does that look like? And why has there been none, as the community advocates have been saying for so long?
Well, I think police departments have a culture of intense self-protection. And the first thing that they do when a police officer kills an unarmed individual, is they circle their wagons and they pull a curtain across any public inquiry or investigation. For instance, the killing of Jessica Williams occurred a week ago, last Thursday, and we still do not have publicly released the names of the officer who shot her or his partner who was with him. We don't have any details. We just know that she was shot one time inside her car, inside a stolen car. The same thing happened with Mario Woods. It was weeks before any of the officers' names were released. That video of Mario Woods was shocking. It just rallied the community. The Bayview Hunters Point community was in such a state after that video was shown and released in the media. And yet the police command staff and the chief, unfortunately, rushed to the microphones and said, "This, I viewed the video. This was a reasonable use of force." The officer acted, one officer acted in self-defense and the other officers acted in defense of that officer. And no one anyone who was not a police officer who was watching that video disagreed wholeheartedly with the chief's assessment. So one of the first things that has to happen is that instantaneous self-protection mode, that very thick blue line, that curtain that gets drawn around them, that has to stop, because they signal by doing that that they are not a part of the community they are policing, and they have no feeling for what has happened. They don't care about the person who's been killed, and they don't care about the people who loved the person who's been killed.
Yeah. Let me just add on the accountability issue, because this is extraordinarily important. We use the terms accountability and transparency, and those are important words. But what they really do mean, exactly what accountability means, someone has to be held accountable for what took place. But the accountability has to start at the very top, because if the chief can say information, misinformation, like he did Chief Sir did in the Mario Woods case, that sends a signal to all other officers, don't worry, I have your back. The mayor, as soon as he realized that the chief had misstated or misdirected or gave disinformation, he should have been fired then, because that went to the very integrity of the police chief. And as I said then, that the integrity of the police chief cannot be, if it's called into question, he cannot lead, because he sends messages to the other officers in the department that I have your back no matter what. So accountability to me starts at the very top, because then that trickles down to everyone else. And the mayor and the police commission have great responsibility in the terms of enforcing the issue of accountability.
Yeah, and in terms of lack of transparency, it's also what we're hearing from all of us is that the police are able to manipulate the evidence. One of the key things here is SFPD is in charge of investigating the homicide committed by the same officers. So there's, at that moment, those officers who shoot and kill someone are suspects in a homicide case. They have all the motivation to withhold information as a department. And so there are reforms on the table already, like the Leno Bill, SB 1268, which is calling for the investigations themselves to become open within 180 days. And if that bill doesn't go through, I would really task the Board of Supervisors to following through on some reforms that increase transparency, both by creating records of complaints. Part of all this problem is that we don't know how many complaints exactly. Who are the officers involved? What type of complaints? What type of use of force? And what has been the consequence? But when we do look at some information, we know that there's ever barely consequences, even whether they are criminal charges, whether they're administrative charges like a suspension or a firing. It's extremely rare. I think the last case of even an administrative consequence was from 1995 I believe it was a fatal encounter, but even the police commission then reversed that case.
I will say this, though. There are issues around accountability that are sort of outside of our ability to control, because police officers have rights that have been given to them by the state legislature.
Right.
And they really do protect officers, and they do prevent the community at large from getting this information. So the challenge that we're faced is not just dealing with the police chief and the mayor, and though it is a question of politics as well, because and then you add to that the unions. Now, no matter what anyone says, the unions are only out for themselves. They want more and more for their officers. They want the culture the same. They want everything to be the status quo. And this is where the issue of accountability comes in, is that the police chief and the mayor's office, they must be able to put forth those reforms and make the police union accept them, assuming that it doesn't go into basic issues of union contract. But most do not, because the police chief has a right to run the department in a way that's consistent with good policing. But he can only do that if he can make sure that he can put the pressure on the police unions through whatever force that can be used. But also, as I keep saying, the real responsibility rests not with the mayor's office, the police commission, and the police chief.
So the suggestions made in the letter that the Racial Justice Committee wrote to the Board of Supervisors specifically called for an independent Office of Citizen Complaints. That's the first request that we made to the Board of Supervisors, to create a separate line item, a budget item, for an independent OCC rather than for one that is tied to funding the police commission. And that request was made because we do not feel that the police department is able to be accountable for the actions of their officers who use excessive force in the line of duty. We just have not seen it happen. I think it'll be very difficult for any chief of police to, start demanding that officers act in a certain way when they're training. And the culture of the police department, which is basically to view African Americans with suspicion and Latino Americans with suspicion. And when I say with suspicion, I mean as more likely than not involved in criminal activity, and these people will be treated with violence. That's addressed in our letter to the Board of Supervisors as well.
And that came out in a lot of the texts that were released.
Exactly. The texts were, the first ones which were released a year ago were so disheartening. It literally was shocking and stomach-turning. We also asked that there be a separate division of internal affairs devoted exclusively to addressing and rooting out bigotry, and we also called for a United States Department of Justice civil rights investigation into this police department.
Mm-hmm. That is Rebecca Young. She is a senior trial attorney with the San Francisco Deputy Public Defender's Office. She co-chairs the Racial Justice Committee. We're also joined by John Burris, a civil rights attorney who specializes in police misconduct. He's been working on these issues for over three decades. And Adriana Camarena is a writer and community advocate in the Mission District. She has been heavily involved with these cases. She's co-founder of the Justice for Alex Nieto Coalition. She's working as an advocate for justice for Luis Gongora Pat, who was killed April 7th, 2016. We did invite the San Francisco Police Department to join us. We never heard back. We also invited Officers for Justice. A few of their police officers have been on the show before, but we never heard back from them. So if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. What questions do you have about what has been happening? What context would you like to provide? What reform would you like to see? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Because there are so many pieces and so many people involved, the Board of Supervisors, the public defenders, community advocates, how much power does the mayor have? How much power does the chief have? Can you give us a very simple explanation of how these decisions are actually made?
Well, the Homicide Division of the San Francisco Police Department investigates any police shooting. And so the police are investigating the police. There is not an outside agency. There's no oversight to the Homicide Division. So the lieutenant in charge of the Homicide Division can report directly to the chief of police. But they're the ones that make the recommendations for whether charges should be filed or not. And that recommendation would then go to the district attorney's office. Since it would involve a police officer, it would go to a very high-level district attorney. So the district attorney has a huge role here that thus far has not been fulfilled. And because even if there is no action taken by the police to make a recommendation of charges being filed, the district attorney is empowered and can do his own investigation. And we haven't seen that. We haven't seen that even with the individual who was shot in the back four times. So,
And do they have to give a reason why?
Only if they're asked. I mean, they're not required. So the district attorney doesn't have somebody, you know, he reports to. He's an elected official and, you know, he can, you know, make a public statement or not. I mean, it really is, as Adriana points out, community pressure that has brought about the most recent and dramatic change with the resignation of Chief Sir.
But even the community pressure has not, John Burris, has not resulted in the district attorney's office filing charges. We have been working closely with them, or at least talking to them as well, on the Mario Woods case. And my sense is they're not going to file charges. And so they always, granted, we're in a situation, political situation here with the police chief and the district attorney's office kind of at odds seeking political gains, but I have not seen anywhere where the district attorney's office has come forward with charges. They should have filed charges in the Mario Woods case, mm-hmm. and they definitely should file charges, murder charges, in the Jessica Williams case, and it remains to see whether that ultimately happens. The other area where some investigation takes place is the Office of Citizens Review, and that's a theoretically an independent body, independent investigations, but I have not seen down through the years where they are holding police officers more accountable than anyone else. So I don't think that that's an agency that we should look to in police shooting cases where we can get some objective evaluations. Now, it is true. One has to understand what the law is in these areas, and having been involved in both areas, I know criminal law is one area that is a challenge to convict police officers. Having been involved in the Oscar Grant case, I know when we had Oscar Grant being shot in the back, mm-hmm. and he gets charged, but he was not convicted anything beyond involuntary manslaughter. I've had other cases where clearly the person should have been prosecuted and the district attorney's office has not done so. There's a reluctance, as far as I can see, short of prosecuting police officers. I do think that that could change with videos. Certainly, if we look around the country where there's been a video involved, then there's those likelihood of being prosecuted has increased, and maybe when we get San Francisco cameras more on board, that could happen as well. But it is disheartening to see the kind of shootings that take place, the more recent shootings, and no criminal prosecution take place. Then it's left up to me and people like me to develop those issues in a civil case, which is not satisfactory to a family because, sure, we can't bring the person back. Nobody gets – the officers are well-protected, they're well-financed, and they never – and in essence, they really don't have to worry about being prosecuted, and that's just a tragedy.
And, you know, following up this on Mr. Burris, I just want to tell Mr. Burris that I know that the civil cases are not the same as a criminal case, but in the case of his clients, the Refugio en Elvira Nieto, when the trial ended, even with a jury verdict against them, they thanked Dante Pointer, who worked on this, because, in their words, they finally knew what happened. Mm. And it actually takes a civil case to investigate the facts. And that was the main goal of the Nieto family. And they achieved it, and they're very grateful.
Well, there's no question about that. I mean, mm-hmm. I have countless cases that we're always working on, and we try to tell families that, look, I have limitations on what I can do, but I can at least bring your case before, and you will get to see what the case is in a civil context. And you're right. Many families, mm-hmm. Certainly at the beginning, they just want to know what happened, and they will feel good about that. And we try to make sure they know that before a case is over as to what actually happened. So that's one positive side to it, no doubt about it.
We're going to take a quick break. Today we are talking about what is happening here in San Francisco, also just the Bay Area with John Burris doing so much work in Oakland. But as you know, Police Chief Greg Suhr resigned recently at the request of Mayor Ed Lee. This happened just hours after Jessica Williams, a 29-year-old unarmed black woman, was shot and killed in the Bayview. We'll talk more about her case after the break. John Burris is a civil rights attorney. Adriana Camarena is a writer and community advocate. And Rebecca Young is a senior trial attorney with the San Francisco Deputy Public Defender's Office. We did invite the SFPD to join us and Officers for Justice, and we did not hear back. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
Your call is better when you get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment at the show's website. Set a bookmark for yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will discuss coverage of President Obama's visits to Vietnam and Japan. President Obama is pushing for the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal, which Public Citizen is calling NAFTA on steroids. He's also making an historic visit to Hiroshima. We'll talk about how reporters cover history and why it is so hard for countries like the United States to apologize for past atrocities. Today, we are talking about police reform and what has been happening in San Francisco over the past, well, many years, because there's a lot more that's been happening than just the past 6 months. That's getting the most media attention, but this goes much further. And we're talking today about what's happening with SFPD and Chief Greg Suhr, who resigned at the request of Mayor Ed Lee last Thursday, just hours after Jessica Williams, a 29-year-old unarmed black woman, was shot and killed in the Bayview. We're joined by Rebecca Young, a senior trial attorney with the San Francisco Deputy Public Defender's Office. She's co-chair of the Racial Justice Committee. Adriana Camarena is a writer and community advocate in the Mission District of San Francisco, co-founder of the Justice for Alex Nieto Coalition. She's also working as an advocate for the Justice for Louis Gongora Pat Coalition. John Burris is a civil rights attorney specializing in police misconduct cases for 3 decades. John represents the Luis Gongora and Mario Woods families. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. John, you were talking about the process that happens after someone is shot and killed. So can we talk about the latest shooting, Jessica Williams? It took a couple days to get information about that. We still don't have that much information. We do know she was 29, unarmed. According to the San Francisco Examiner, 2 Bayview officers came upon a stolen car in the Silver Terrace area. Williams was reportedly driving the car. She attempted to flee, crashed into a truck. The officers attempted to remove her from the car, and a witness told police there was a back and forth between her and the officers. She was shot once by one of the officers shortly before 10 o'clock a.m. So, John, what happens after someone is shot? Just walk us through the process.
Well, what happens typically in cases in a police shooting of some kind, the police then come in, arguably they freeze the scene, and then they look for whatever markings of potential evidence. The most important, from my point of view, is the gunshot casings. Where are they in relationship to where the body is? Because you want to determine the direction in which a bullet enters a particular body to determine the position that they were in. So second thing that happens, the pathologist comes or the coroner's office comes and removes the body and takes the body away, and there will be a pathology, an autopsy will be performed to determine the cause of death. But more importantly, they want to determine what kind of drugs were on board. Did that person have any drugs in their system to determine what impact effect that might have had on her, on that person's conduct. But obviously, what we're looking to see is what is the angle of the path of the bullet through the body. So that's a separate issue, and that becomes very, very critical for us in determining a lot about what the case is and what the person did in reference to it. We also know that the police are going to go out and try to interview everybody they can about it, and what they typically do was to try to find witnesses who support the police officer's version. If the person doesn't support the police officer's version, sometimes they get lost or they don't get interviewed completely where it's written down, and or their statements are distorted. But that's certainly the first part of what you're trying to do, is trying to freeze the scene, get as much information as you can about it, and then later you start conducting sort of a reconstruction of the scene if you can. You try to figure out, the police try to figure out where everybody was in connection with it. And basically it's a CSI type activity that takes place. And that happens in almost every case. From my point of view, we then have to come behind that to some extent and determine whether the police officers, the police department itself, missed any particular thing. And so that's the process. And generally, the officers will find that the police officer's conduct was justifiable. I'm not so certain they will do that in Jessica Williams' case, because the community outcry here, this is a case where very easily there could be a criminal prosecution here for murder or some other offense. It looks more like a murder case, a second-degree murder, than anything else. But generally, that is what takes place at the very outset of a case, to sort of get as much information as you can at the outset. The best thing possible, if there are video cameras, to get whatever those videos are. They may be around the neighborhood in various locations. You want to get those video cameras. You want to find out if anybody is on the scene that has their own personal cameras, which we had in the Mario Woods case, which makes that case, which really contradicted what Chief Sir had to say. And that's very, very important. Now, in some cases, we don't have that. Then I just finished the case, the shooting case, where we then have to look at the physical evidence to see if it squares up what the officers had to say. So it's really CSI type work that takes place from my point of view, and certainly from the police point of view.
But the other thing that happens in terms of the blue line and the curtain being drawn around them is, you know, the homicide division shows up. Whether or not the person died, homicide goes. And they take the officer involved in the shooting. They take his gun, and it's going to be examined by CSI. It is not sent to an independent lab. It's sent to the police lab. And then that officer or officers then meet with a lawyer from the POA and or a representative from the POA in a room before any interview happens of the officer.
And the POA is?
The Police Officers Association. It's sort of the, you know, what we might call the police union, but they're far beyond a union. They do way more than that. And they're very powerful and they're very well funded.
And they have lawyers.
And they have lawyers. Right. And the officer involved in the shooting meets with a POA representative and attorney prior to being interviewed. So, and then during the interview has a representative and or an attorney with him or her.
The most critical part of this, though, if there are two or three people present, that lawyer will go between the various people, get the story from one person, takes that story to the other person,
right,
and they talk about it, and they merge these stories. And I'll give you a classic example. In our Oscar Grant case with Meserly, on the scene, made a statement to the effect, I think he had a gun. Okay? That's why I did what I did. Ultimately, he gets interviewed by his lawyers, and several days later, he comes out with another story. That story was, I was planning to go for my taser as opposed to my gun. That story was totally fabricated. And we see this often when lawyers go between the various police officers.
Okay, so what changes would you like to see to deal with that?
Well, number one, that officers have to give a statement immediately, like everyone else. Everyone else, they should give a statement immediately. Now, they're going to have their lawyer present, but they have to give that statement within a short period of time. They don't get 2 days or whatever period of time they want to not have to give that statement, because that's crucial. And the other thing is this. If the officer, and this is a new thing that's coming up, if there is a video that an officer has and who has been involved in the shooting, he or she does not get to see the video of camera videos, cell phone videos, before they give a statement.
And are they now?
Well, in some jurisdictions they are. And in San Francisco, I don't know if this issue hasn't come up as much because we're still, it's relatively new. Mm-hmm. But it's going to be an issue because cameras are going to be given to officers. They're going to be on their cars. They're going to be on their shoulders. And the point is, I know that we did a snoping, you cannot see that video before you give your statement.
Right. Yeah, and the body cameras are not yet in use in San Francisco, right, but the policy has been drafted, right, and the police commission thus far has recommended that where in cases where the police officer is a witness or is involved in a shooting, that they are not allowed to review their body camera video prior to making a statement.
Are body cameras coming soon in San Francisco?
We've been hearing that for a couple of years now.
Okay, and then there's the question about when they will be turned on and off.
Well, that's addressed in the policy as well.
Okay.
And it should be as soon as detention's being made, about to be made, it has to be turned on.
The issue here,
one of the things,
I'll give you one point.
And just piggybacking on this too, like, okay.
I was going to say, to follow up on this one point. There has to be a disciplinary function related to if you don't turn it on when it's supposed to be turned on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There has to be discipline.
Yeah.
I'm sorry about that.
No, it's great. We're all really passionate about this. and this is, it comes, we're starting to get to the nitty gritty here. So let's say we all have cameras and these shootings are on tape. And even with that, it's really difficult to get any criminal charges or any accountability because there are several levels of reform. We've already talked about lack of transparency, that we don't have the facts, and I was starting to mention how difficult it is for the families or any victim of violent crime. The first thing you want to know and their families want to know is what happened. So that's a big issue around lack of transparency. The other one is, like, who handles the investigation? That's why you always hear the cry or bring in the DOJ in an independent civil rights division investigation, which I'd like to point out that the Board of Supervisors in San Francisco called for the DOJ to come in and look at the Alex Nieto, Mario Woods, and Amilcar Perez Lopez cases because it seemed like there was a lot of mishandling of the evidence in those cases. And then the final thing is, like, even if you had a good investigation, even if you have a video, can you make these officers accountable? And it gets to one of the biggest issues, which is the standard of use of force that's in the SFPD general order. And we're calling for reform because what it ends up happening is that there's a huge discretion for the officers to use lethal force in any circumstance in which they perceive there's a threat to their safety or risk of death. But it ends up being that when you look at the judicial precedents and when it gets to court, especially in a criminal case where the standard is even higher, beyond a reasonable doubt, and in a civil case is by preponderance of evidence, that you rarely have criminal charges pressed, which is why we see, for example, the district attorney, George Gascon, in the case of Amilcar Perez Lopez. Let me just give you a few facts. He was killed in late February of 2015, actually just across my house. And so what happened in that case is that it said that Amilcar was having a confrontation with someone. He had a knife in his hand. He was walking or chasing behind someone who had a bicycle. They were part of a group of people who knew each other. And so what happens is that the two officers undercover officers are just riding down the street. They see the scene. They jump out of the car. They start chasing after both these two people. They jump Amilcar Perez Lopez from behind. And Amilcar Perez wiggles out of their grasp and drops the knife from witness accounts. And then immediately the officers get up and shoot him six times. So what we see in these cases is that in the first town hall meeting, first of all, they had the body placed on the sidewalk to they were creating a narrative in which they say Amilcar lunged at him. But because the civil attorney in that case, Arnoldo Casillas, asked for an independent autopsy, like Mr. Burrs was mentioning, happens in many of these cases, they were able to prove that there were six shots to his back. And so then the police start changing their narrative, and there are photos now that the body was actually in the street. It changes their narrative. And this is why we often call not only for a reform to how these investigations are handled. And what we're suggesting as a group of coalition demands is that we should look into having a special prosecutor independent of the DA. Why? Because the DA and SFPD have a daily cooperative relationship for the purpose of solving crime. Mm-hmm. But when that criminal is within the SFPD department, there's a conflict of interest. Then the other issue is let's talk about the SFPD general order.
Adriana Camarena is a writer and community advocate in the Mission District. Rebecca Young is San Francisco Deputy Public Defender. John Burris is a civil rights attorney. He's been working on these cases for over 30 years. And let's go to a few callers. Let's hear from Diamond Dave in San Francisco. Hi, welcome to the show.
Hey, I just happen to be half a block or a block away when Jessica Williams was killed. And that was a week ago today. And yet we've heard so little what happened. I was on the periphery. I was waiting for a bus in the corner of, Bayshore and Industrial. I was down Industrial, not in the Bayview, just half a block down Industrial. And I could tell something bad had happened. I knew it was a shooting of some sort. And I'm waiting for the bus. And I'm saying, what's going on here? To myself, and a cop car suddenly pulls up. This cop comes up, jumps out, and just at the corner of Bayshore and Industrial, it kind of jumps out, and somebody turns off Bayshore and Industrial. He pulls his gun out and puts it to the guy's head. This is right in front of me, 10 feet away. Puts it to his head and said, move, turn around, get out of here. And I looked at that cop, and he was freaked out. Something was going on, and yet we've heard very little about what's happened with Jessica Williams. We've heard it was a sergeant. A sergeant apparently was in plain clothes, I don't know. And another cop who was assigned to, and it's so mysterious, assigned to the stolen cars. And apparently they saw her, and it turns out her boyfriend, they say, was asleep in a car right next to it where she was killed, and was at a spot where they were meeting. I don't know.
Dave, we were just talking. Yes, go ahead.
Taking an interest. It seems like you're taking an interest in this, whether she's a woman or not. I'm not prepared to say, but little seems to have been done about Jessica Williams. And I'd like to, Burris, if you are, I'd like to give you my number off the air. I gave a number off the air because I was there. I didn't see her being killed. I knew some shooting. I could feel that somebody had been shot, but that's all I could see. But I did see this cop, a red-faced cop with a gun in his hand, pointing it right at the head of somebody who just happened to turn off Bayshore onto Industrial.
All right, Diamond Dave, we'll get your number. Just hold tight there. Adriana, you want to comment?
You know, it's really interesting. After these shootings, you think that the police would pull back, and you often see that they're actually being more aggressive. And I also saw police officers seven officers pulling guns on some young men at a corner like 2 weeks after the Alex Nieto shooting. But in any case, I want to encourage people to place OCC complaints. Call them up. It's the Office of Citizens Complaints. They are the ones who are in charge of investigating and suggesting an administrative consequence for the officers. If it's less than the 10-day suspension, they can directly recommend it. But if it's anything other than that, like a firing, it goes to the police commission. There are huge issues with the OCC, basically because they don't actually have subpoena power. It takes a complaint to activate them. And then the police commission is something that we're also seeking to reform, maybe create an elected body of officials, because they're actually right now seven members, four appointed by the mayor, and three are appointed by the Board of Supervisors, which means that there's a lot of political interest in who's on the police commission, and the majority will go through the mayor's political interest, which right now, as we've seen, favors police. But if you create, it's our only way right now to really have some access to number of complaints. So at least in any of these cases or in this incident that they've sought, make your complaint. You'll be able to follow up with them.
You know, I don't know that I always agree with sending people to OCC complaints.
Because they're a little toothless.
Not the OCC as it's currently configured,
yeah.
I would agree.
Okay.
I agree. I have real reservation about it because they really generally, 95% of the time, file on behalf of the police. And then the examination of witnesses, I don't believe it's objective in many ways. I think that they, you know, they think they want to do a good job, but many of them, most of the time they rule in favor of the police. And so therefore another statement is being given, particularly if a person is it's not a death case, then that statement, because the people are not always very sophisticated in terms of what's happening to them, generally is to their disadvantage when I find the case in civil cases. So I'm not a big fan of it. It could be, because I think there's good intentions in terms of having an independent body, but because it's political in nature in terms of how people are there, I just don't think that it works that well for independent people. Sometimes it does, though. Sometimes it does a good job.
The position of the OCC is that if it's the statement of the individual against the officer, they will never sustain a finding of misconduct.
You know, one of the big issues there is, how do you categorize? This is an important point. How do you categorize the various claims? If a person comes in and they make a claim, and if the police can't find anything to corroborate, and the commission, or the OCC, they will basically reach a finding that it's unfounded.
Right.
And it's been my experience that people do not go to these groups, to lie. They go because something bad has happened. You may not be able to prove it, but it's not unfounded. It might be not sustained. And this is critical, because if it's unfounded, it does not go into the police officer's file. But if it's not sustained, it does. And so we had this huge fight in Oakland about the objective interviews of investigation of these claims. And my position is people don't go and lie. What they want is justice. But yet when you rule that it's none founded, you're basically saying these people have come to the department, have lied about what happened to them. And it's not the case.
I want to ask you about race. Dennis has a question. He writes, I agree with John Burris's assertion that video cameras on each police person and car would help reduce the number of these incidents. I'd like to know what Mr. Burris and other guests think about whether the police currently receive anti-racism training as part of their initial training and whether they think it would make a difference. I'm trying to get at the mindset of the police in respect to how they act towards people of color while on the job. Before you answer that question, what did you all think of these texts and how much weight do you put on them? I mean, they're pretty horrible. I mean, there were 3 years of texts. What was it? 2011, 2012. I mean, you've got them talking about blacks, N-words, in response to a text saying N should be sprayed. One officer wrote, I saw one an hour ago with four kids. If your kids are with blacks, watch out. We got two blacks at my boy's school. They're a brother and a sister. Their dad works for the school district. I'm watching them like hawks.
Yeah, there's also the aspect of the text messages that is particularly concerning is that they reveal race hatred and a tendency toward violence based on race hatred. That is the concern. And when that is the context, these text messages provide a backdrop for all these shootings and killings of black and brown men. So you cannot view these incidents independently of each other. And it is really true that even, you know, Sergeant Firminger came out and said, I was joking. This was just blowing off steam. Really? You blow off steam by talking about how cross-burning lowers your blood pressure? So even let's just for a moment say, okay, I believe you, Ian Firminger. You were joking and blowing off steam. It's inappropriate. It's unprofessional. And for your supervisor, this should be hugely concerning. These text messages were turned over to the command staff and nothing was done. And so the other 12 officers who were not prosecuted for any crimes by the U.S. Attorney's Office went undisciplined, unpunished, absolutely nothing happened to them, because there is a culture in the San Francisco Police Department of just looking the other way.
You know, I have to tell you that it's more than that. And I don't mean negatively. It's just more because, look, the real damning aspect of all of this is not the stuff that we know about. It's the racial profiling. That is the stopping of people and searching them, pulling them out of their cars, handcuffing them, and letting them go. because that happens on a routine basis daily, and that goes to the very heart of this whole question of being a good, of being a citizen or not. And so what we've determined in looking at this, the question of is there racial, there's clearly a form of bias that exists within police agencies of this kind. We call it implicit bias, but I think the implicit bias permeates the whole criminal justice system, no, in my mind about that. But I don't believe that officers get the kind of training that tackles this kind of inherent stereotypic bias that they have about African Americans, Latinos, et cetera. I don't think that they do. And I think that subconsciously, without being overtly racist, they do these things based upon the culture that they have. This, as I wrote in my book, that one culture in police departments, cultures are passed down from generation to generations. And you come in as a new officer, and what you find out is this is how we treat the black people, this is how we treat the Mexican people, this is how we treat the Latinos. That becomes part of your policing. And that's the task and the challenge we have in trying to break this whole issue of how people are treated. And that's to me, is at the top of the list in terms of what a new reform has to occur.
And so, I even feel really strong about this issue that people ask, should we have tasers? Should we have body cams? What should we do? Should we have more training? I'm like, I actually, personally, don't care. Because until there is an accountability, there could be all sorts of anti-racism training. We could have body cams. But if we don't change the standards that allow the officers to use force, there is not going to be any accountability. If we don't change the ways investigations are handled, there isn't going to be any accountability. And so we can talk about these other policies, and I think we should, but until we get to like the core of the issues, we're not going to see accountability. And as we like to say, without consequence, there's no confidence, and that's a deep erosion of trust in institutions.
And Rebecca, 30 seconds.
I agree completely. I spoke with Chief Sir last year about implicit bias training. It is not part of the academy. However, he was seeking funding, and he got funding for the command staff to take it. But as far as I know, as of now, the patrol staff.
One point. In Oakland, we've hired a psychologist from Stanford as part of our whole writers program. And she has looked very closely at the question of implicit bias. And so we're looking at that issue and seeing what can be done in terms of the profiling of people being arrested and stopped, et cetera.
Well, we should do another show about that and maybe have her on.
Right. Oh, she's great.
John Burris is a civil rights attorney specializing in police misconduct cases for over 30 years. Adriana Camarena is a writer and advocate in the Mission District of San Francisco. Rebecca Young is San Francisco's deputy public defender. We did invite the San Francisco Police Department to join us and Officers for Justice, but they did not get back to us. Rebecca, Adriana, and John, thank you all for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll discuss coverage of President Obama's visits to Vietnam and Japan. He's pushing the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal, which Public Citizen calls NAFTA on steroids. He's also making an historic visit to Hiroshima. How are reporters covering this history, and why it's so hard for countries to apologize for past atrocities? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Debbie Kennedy is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.